This is Sci-Fi Tech Talk.
Welcome to Sci-Fi Tech Talk, the podcast where we explore the technology of sci-fi. I'm Jeff Sire, and with me today is Julie Keel.
Hello.
And Mike McPeak.
Hello.
And we have finally arranged a time when all three of us are available to do this movie. So today we're doing The Man from Earth. So, and I'll read the synopsis from iTunes. On a cold night in a remote cabin, Professor John Oldman, what a convenient name, gathers his most trusted colleagues for an extraordinary announcement. He is an immortal who has migrated through 140 centuries of evolution and now must move on. The Oldman... Is Oldman truly Cro-Magnon or simply insane? Now one man will force these scientists and scholars to confront their own notions of history, religion, humanity, all leading to the final revelation that may shatter their world forever.
Yawn.
So, okay. We'll just say up front.
Spoiler.
There is no tech whatsoever in this movie.
Spoiler, there's no science in this movie. Spoiler, there's no fiction. There's no, it's all fiction. Boy, there's like nothing in this movie. There's six guys, I don't know how many people sitting on couches in a cabin. That's it.
I will suggest to anybody that is going to watch this, that has listened so far and hasn't watched it yet.
Don't.
if you're going to watch it, maybe watch it like... I think I was lucky in that I watched maybe about 15 minutes. I thought, what a piece of garbage. And I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I read what they said about it on Wikipedia. So if you listen to what we say about it, I think you can have a better appreciation of it in that I don't think this is a good movie, but I think it could have been a very good play.
Well, and I'm kind of surprised. I was thinking that you guys would like this a little bit more because, you know, like we always say on here, it all goes back to Star Trek, and this really goes back to Star Trek.
This goes back to, like, Space Odyssey 2001, you know.
Well, no, but the thing is, though, the guy that wrote this, I got to find his name now, Bixby, Jerome Bixby, wrote the episode of Star Trek, Methuselah. There we go. Yep. One of them words. So he actually, this was the same basic plot as that. And there's a couple Star Trek tie-ins here because several of the actors have been on different Star Trek shows.
That had to get cleared up right away. I kept looking, going, I know that voice. I know that voice. Where is that voice? So yes, definitely had to look that one up.
Well, there are several familiar faces. Yep. There's no big name actors. Probably the closest is William Catt. But there's a lot of people. I was sitting there going, I've seen him, but I don't remember where. So, you know, they're all familiar faces, but they're not big name actors. And there's been a few of them that's been on a Star Trek, and I don't remember what roles and which, you know, episodes.
John Billingsley was like the cook on Enterprise.
Oh, okay, that's it.
Yep.
Right. I know I'd seen him somewhere, and I could kind of see him in a Star Trek show,
right.
But I don't remember which one.
Yep. Yep, that was the one that was like, the voice gave it away. And he somewhat had the same bubbly personality, but of course the look was completely different as well as the context. So, yeah,
right.
that one was like, okay, stop the show, figure out who that is, because it's driving me crazy.
Well, then Tony Todd was in 7 episodes and 1 video game of Star Trek.
Yeah.
John Reel guest stars in Star Trek The Next Generation, Star Trek Voyager, and Star Trek Enterprise.
Yeah, this you want to talk about your classic low-budget flick? We're talking a handful of cast members and one set. You know, they could have made this for, I don't know, $30,000. If that.
Well, they had a $200,000 budget. So.
Oh, well, they spent way too much.
Oh, I think you're being, like, I can see there is, like, a good concept behind this.
Yeah, I can too. It's a shit movie. It's a great discussion.
And I think it's a great discussion, and I think it's overacted. And when I stopped watching it and I read the Wikipedia entry and I started thinking about it as a play, if you watch it with the idea of it as a play, then the way they're acting doesn't seem as weird because they totally are exaggerating things. And when you see a play on stage, they have to emote so much bigger because they have to project to the audience. Whereas on a movie or in television, they don't have to do that because the camera's right there. But these people, like, they're just like they're playing it like they're on stage, mm-hmm. and they're being almost to the point that they're hammy.
Yeah, you know, until you said that, I mean, the minute you said that, it suddenly became that makes a lot of sense. It feels like a play again. You have one set.
Yeah, you're just in the one cabin. Yeah,
it's somebody decided to take a play and turn it into a movie. Thank God it was only an hour and a half. But I mean, it's have you heard of or read the book Ishmael?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Anybody who might have actually read that book, this movie reminds me of that book where I'm not even going to give spoilers on Ishmael. We may have to read that one now that you guys haven't. But it's the book is essentially a vehicle for a guy to think through this strange hypotheses, you know, this historical reference on how humanity got to be where it is, or, you know, in this case, how this man got to be where it is, which is just kind of a bigger picture of how humanity got to be where it is. And so it's just it's the whole darn thing is a plot device to have this discussion. You know, it's like an academic debate in a movie. Hence my rant that's just going to go on for the next hour about this being a shit movie. It's a great discussion. It's just a shit movie.
Yeah.
Hey. Well, I thought the whole discussion about when they got to the, you know, the religion part of it, I thought that was kind of, you know, interesting that, you know, where the guy inadvertently became Jesus or inspired the Jesus story or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And there's, you know, so much of, well, as they talk about in the show, I mean, so much of that, of history, the way we look back on history is not how history is experienced. You know, we're in the middle of something right now. Well, we won't know what we're in the middle of for a good 10 years, probably more like 100. You know,
but I've thought about that a few times, and I've had conversations with people about, like, if you went back to the turn of the 20th century, so like 1901, and you went to New York City or you went to London, England, and you asked them who's the most powerful country on earth, probably in both cities they would say Great Britain because they have these huge empires. But looking back now, we know that the United States had already eclipsed Britain in their power. But like you're saying, like, in the day, and like even right today, we're too close to really have kind of the long view of even what's going on in the world today, like, because we're still just we're too close to it, right?
Yeah. They even make reference in the movie to the JFK assassination, and they were talking about that just being a blip in time, and that's, you know, 50 years ago. Plus years ago at this point too, so, you know, it's history only becomes history through the passage of time, and the farther away, the greater the myth of history, the legend of history.
Sure.
You know, the actual details of history get lost, even if they're written, because you can't write everything. You can't, even if all the world is taking selfies and Periscope videos, even now we can't duplicate or replicate the experience of living through it. And maybe we never will, and maybe we will, and nobody will care. Because really, you can't live two lives at the same time. So, history, you know, they always say history is written by the victors, and history is rewritten as time goes on. Like, if you go to high school right now, you will have, like, in America, you will have world history prior to, like, the founding of the United States, and world history meaning Western Europe. And then you'll have from, like, the founding of the United States till possibly the Civil War or World War II. Usually one of those two are the breakpoints. And then you have modern history. And those are treated like the same. Like you get 3 months on world history prior to the revolution. You get 3 months on history from revolution to, I don't know, Civil War, World War II, and then you get 3 months on modern history. Like those are equal periods of time, you know. Yeah. So we really get a distorted view of history with an emphasis on what's most recent and very little perspective on what came before.
Well, you know, you said Victor's right, history, but I think we understand history the way we want to. We're all going to bring our worldview to history, and we're going to see what we want and how we want to see it. And everyone every group of people is going to be a little bit different on how they see things. One will see, a glorious empire. Others will see oppression. So,
That's a really good point. Yeah, because you're looking at history through the glasses of your own experience and your own time, right? Like I know we've said it before about how we look back at doctors who used leeches as like, oh, look at those idiots. Well, no, they weren't any stupider than we are. Like they were, like we haven't evolved a lot in the last 400 years, and they were doing the best that they could with the technology that they had at the time. And if you don't have the benefit of knowing about germ theory, knowing about all of the things that we benefit from today, you would do exactly the same thing. Yeah.
I thought that was a really interesting thing that they did bring up in this show. This guy has apparently been alive for 140 centuries, 14,000 years. And he was a smart enough guy. He was a college professor, apparently, and it's later on you find out he actually has 10 degrees, some of which might be a couple hundred years old. PhDs, I should mention. He also made the point that he's like, I'm no smarter than anybody else. I'm not a genius. I can't see things that other people can't see because you can only understand, I can't remember how they put it, but you can only understand based on the knowledge that you have. And as humanity has this knowledge that, one person, even if they have a lot of history, isn't going to be able to go beyond that boundary and, make leaps at little people, occasionally people poke at that boundary. You got the Einsteins and the Hawkins and the Galileos back in the day or whatever, but the boundary is there. Nobody's leaping over that boundary, regardless, even if you had 140 centuries worth of life. You can't go past that. You can't leapfrog past that. So
right.
I thought that was accurate, actually. It was an interesting way to put it. And it was, I guess from what I understand, I suppose you could say my belief, my understanding of how history happens, how breakthroughs happen, how science happens, that's true. We get to a point as a collective that we have all this information, and the next step is just the next step.
I think time and experience give you wisdom, but they don't necessarily give you intelligence. And those two things are very different, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, and knowledge is always kind of a moving target because, what we thought was absolutes, like at the turn of the century have now changed. And I'm pretty sure that the things that we consider, although hopefully we're, enlightened enough to think, maybe not so much in absolutes, but, I'm sure that some of the things that we thought were pretty sure, like say a century down the road will probably be disproven or something. So, it's... You learn what you need for the time that you're in. And I don't know if a lot of past knowledge, will help you a lot. I mean, there's certain practical things you can learn.
Well, and I think you would forget things, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I remember having arguments with my mother about calculators, because calculators are going to be the death of the human race, because, you should be able to do math off the top of your head, right? People are going to be stupid because they depend on calculators. It's like, yeah, and you're going to be cooking on a campfire in the backyard, right?
What? When you look back, everybody has that snobbish appeal, like look back at the generation that's coming, this newfangled technology is going to be the death of us, because Plato and Aristotle said the same things about writing.
Yep.
They said, now that we have all this, you know, we have more paper and people are just writing stuff down, that's going to be the death of memory. People won't have to remember things.
And like the printing press.
Yeah, everything is like every generation looks at the next generation coming and says, look at these slackers, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, even on the news, I saw something about, I forget what they called it, but basically people don't remember telephone numbers anymore because they're on your phone and you just look up whoever you want to call. Excuse me. And they're saying that, you know, maybe you should remember certain key phone numbers that you need to call because if you don't have your cell phone handy, how are you supposed to call them? So, you know, there's...
No, we're... Technology will solve that because you don't remember IP addresses either. You just remember web domains. So all we need is a global embedded domain name server for phone numbers, and you will never need to know a phone number again. Why we even bother with them anymore, I'm not 100% certain.
And I've known people in my life that would then be screaming New World Order about right now. And yeah.
Well, that happened about 50 years ago, so...
Right.
Whatever. Yeah. Voice over IP is a thing. I mean, there's all, how many businesses have made the switch because it's cheaper? So, you know, the fact that voice over IP, it makes it quite easy, really, to just do away with phone numbers and just put who do you want to reach and where.
Yeah. Well, and I know, like, you are way more, you know, internet savvy than me with, like, the underpinnings of code and stuff like that, but I know that there's a push on now to change away from IP addresses and bond information to things. So rather than have like an individual site, each piece of information would be coded, so you can just access information directly rather than specific sites or something like that?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're getting at, but there's a couple of things that come to mind when you start talking, one of which is the fact that we've run out of IP addresses, basically. So we have IPv6 rather than IPv4 happening. And then, yeah, the Internet of Things is going to be an interesting one. You're also kind of hinting at schema, where basically it doesn't – a piece of information like a telephone number, you just have to wrap it in code that says this is a telephone number. And then the internet knows what to do with that. So, like, you can tap on that telephone number on your phone, and it will dial. And with phones coming to desktops, soon you'll be able to click on a phone number on your, you know, desktop computer, and it will call them on Skype. So, yeah, that whole separating of data from location or presentation or, you know, tying it to any particular thing. Being able to access it wherever, however. It's already here. Matter of fact, that's what keeps me up at night, trying to keep up with that stuff. And I don't know it all. At all. Please, no.
You just need 140 centuries.
Yeah, that's it. Except, and that would catch me up with what's going on right now. Everything new, just stop. Just stop so I can catch up, okay? Just, yeah. Anyway.
Well, I thought it was kind of interesting, you know, one of the people asked him, I don't remember the specific thing, but, something about maybe the French Revolution or something like that. You know, where was he or what was he doing? He asked the other person, where were you a year ago?
Right, yep.
So, I mean, he's not saying that he's, some sort of superhuman beyond the fact that he's lived this long. But, I mean, he has no special skills, no special abilities. He's basically just an ordinary person that for, you know, some strange reason. And they were discussing that, too, about the possibility of a human being, you know, some quirk of nature being able to regenerate himself over and over again so he would never really age. But, you know, he said he was beyond that. There was nothing really special about him. You know, they could have easily made him into some sort of, you know, megalomaniac or, you know, somebody out to control the world or, you know, something like that. But no, he was just, you know, an ordinary person that's seen a lot in his life and was just trying to deal with it the same way that the rest of us are.
Yeah, there are a couple of things I found really interesting about that. One was his memories of the distant past. I mean, if I think of memories from my childhood, it's the same as he described. There's an image here, a quick memory there. I can kind of remember the layout of the house and how to get to Sears from where we lived and those types of things. But I'm not exactly sure how I walked to school. I really don't remember the walking to school thing. So, you know, you have this very sparse, sporadic, random
Well,
and figure that going back 140,000 years or 14,000 years.
And you're probably going to remember it the way you want to remember it, not necessarily the way that it actually was.
And sometimes you remember it because people tell you about it, or you have a photo of it, or you've seen a place again later, you know, so you kind of create your own memories. You kind of make them up almost.
Yeah.
And that's what proven too.
Have you guys ever had an instance where you have a specific event that you remember vividly, and then you go and talk to the people that were there, and over time you realize that you...
Uh-oh, we lost him. No. There he is. No, Jeff, where'd you go?
You all have a recorder. You just retell yourself these stories. Am I gone? Or
no,
am
you're
I still
back.
Here?
You're back.
Okay.
No.
Okay. But you retell yourself these stories, and over time, because you're retelling them, you're rewriting them each time.
Yep.
I heard the example of this professor wanted to test this idea. So he picked an event where he knew everybody would have a great memory of it. So he said September 11th. So he talked to because he was at this university, and he knew that he'd gone to this guy's office. So he just contacted the other people that were in the office, and he wanted them to – he didn't want to tell them really why, but he just said, can you write down everything that happened that morning, just that, you know, the interactions that we had and what we said and stuff like that. So he contacted – I think he said it was the two other people that he said, you know, okay, well, these other two guys, I hung out with them for the whole morning, and we were in the office watching the TV, and we were talking about it. And he said the first thing that happened was when he was contacting these guys, one of the other guys said, well, what about Bob? He was there too. This guy had no memory that there was a fourth person there. And the other two guys like, oh, yeah, Bob was here the whole time. He completely had forgotten that. Yep. And he had already written his story without this other fourth person in it.
Yep.
And he said when he got the four things and read them, like they agreed on a bunch of things, but very rarely did all four of them agree on anything.
Which is why eyewitness accounts are very flaky.
And we put so much credence in them, and they're terrible.
Yep, they're horrible as far as actual facts. I mean, like you say, you can get corroboration, and that's about as good as you can get on eyewitness accounts.
But you're so sure of it because that's your personal truth, and you're not lying. I'm not a liar.
No.
This is what happened because you've told yourself that.
There's a great Star Trek episode I thought that did an excellent job of showing how, you know, an event happened. This was on The Next Generation. I remember Geordi LaForge was, I can't remember the name of the episode, but he was basically on trial for murder because something had happened. And or is it Data? No. Anyway, but something had happened and somebody had gotten killed, and there were eyewitnesses. There were like four or five eyewitnesses, and the episode was they went through this trial and they got all these eyewitness accounts, and these eyewitness accounts were very, very different from each other. And as it turns out, at the end they could piece together the actual truth. I don't remember if Data did it or if it was recorded or whatever, but it turned out nobody was lying. Everybody told the truth from their perspective. Even though it sounded like and it looked like two of those at least were mutually exclusive, they could not both have happened, but from their perspective they were telling the absolute truth, but the truth with a capital T was something completely different. And that's I mean, to me, that was such a great demonstration of how everybody can be doing their best to tell you exactly what they know and what they saw, but nobody's got the full story.
Right.
Well, it was kind of, you know, it was kind of that way when he, you know, because what he was saying was he took the teachings of Buddha, I believe it was, and was going to try and introduce that, you know, again, and he just kind of ended up, I think people were searching for something, you know, some way, some truth, you know, something, and he said, you know, that's how he, you know, sort of accidentally, you know, became Jesus, and it really freaked out the, you know, the devout Christian woman, that, you know, you know, and everyone's trying to determine if this is, you know, if he's telling the truth or if this is, you know, an elaborate story that he's telling. Because, you know, until maybe the very end, you're not really sure. But, you know, I just thought it was kind of fascinating that, you know, he was trying to do something good for the world, and it kind of took on its own form and grew.
What I found interesting was everybody's reactions. You know, everybody had to push back against this. There was only one guy, essentially, through the whole thing who was willing to hear it out. Right. Everybody else wanted to argue with it. And there really was only one person who said, hear it out. Tell me the whole thing. You know, let me wrap my head around what you're saying, not judgmentally, just let me hear what you have to say, you know. And that's I thought was pretty dead on too. Everybody always wants to argue if somebody else is telling a story. It's like, it's not your story, let them tell the story.
Well, and I thought it was kind of interesting too, where they were, you know, making the supposition that this is how maybe vampire stories got started, was, you know, something along that line. And
yeah, the psychologist was an interesting twist in this one. I mean, basically, we have set absolutely zero stage for this, too. And you know, saying that people, I mean, I'm not going to tell anybody to go watch this thing. But, you know, it's basically a bunch of academics having a goodbye party for this guy who has just decided to pick up and leave and essentially dodged out of his own goodbye party at the office, and they essentially tracked him down at the cabin. So you had a group of people, which is, can I just say that from an academic standpoint, was weird because you had all these cross-discipline things. That typically doesn't happen to be. Everybody from your department would show up,
right.
But not, in this case, we had a biologist, an anthropologist, a psychologist. I'm not even sure what the other ones were. An actual history person. So, you know, that the idea that you had a cross discipline was awesome, again, for the plot of the story. I'm not going to call it a movie. But, you know, Mulligan there, I guess. Yeah, it's it was interesting that they had the psychologist there to push like he did in ways that he did. I'm not sure that was. That was the one part where I thought, you know, I wasn't quite sure if they. I don't want to say it was making me uncomfortable, and I don't want to say it was stupid, but it was like, what are you trying to do here? I mean, as a piece of this movie, this play that was done on film. What's the point of, you know, the psychologist kind of going off the deep end and going way?
Well, you know, part of, well, you know, they had said his wife had just passed away.
Yeah, so why is that a part of this?
Well, I don't know. I
think that sets up the ending. That sets up the heart attack thing at the end.
Oh, that could be.
For why that would affect him so dramatically.
Yeah, that could be.
Well, since we're probably just going to spoil this, what did you guys think of that ending?
Meh.
I wasn't surprised.
Okay.
So.
You know, because, you know, he finds out that this guy is actually his father, and then he has a heart attack and dies. Well, okay. I don't know. I thought it was, well, yeah, I don't know what to think of it either. I mean, it was somewhat interesting, but, because she asked him, you've never seen one of your grown children die before. So, you know, it sounds like he's always been moving on, but. You know, if he does this, well, I suppose in the modern times he's done this every 10 years because when people start to realize that he doesn't grow old, he needs to move on. So, but, you know, in prehistoric times when there wasn't a lot of people, I just would imagine he spent a lot of time alone. So, you know, I don't.
He said that to some extent.
Right. But, I mean, in modern times, how much – I mean, I realize the world's a big place, but every 10 years you would think that, you know, in a matter of a few centuries – you would have covered a lot of ground. I suppose maybe they wouldn't – then you could restart recycling where you've been, because hopefully they wouldn't remember you unless you made some, you know, contribution to society back then, and they would remember you for it. I suppose he had learned to keep a low profile throughout his life.
Well, I will give him credit for that. He was essentially an average, ordinary, humble guy. There was nothing extraordinary about his looks. I mean, it wasn't like – dashingly handsome, but he wasn't horribly ugly. He wasn't malformed or disfigured, or I mean, he was just this guy. He was one of these blend into the background type of guys. So, you know, as long as he's hanging out in the white world, He'd be pretty nondescript. In the dark Africa, he'd probably stand out a little, or in China, or, you know.
Yeah.
South America, maybe even. So, you know, depending on where he's hanging out, I think he'd have a pretty easy time of fading into the background. But the trick there, too, is occupation. I mean, in this particular lifetime, if we call it that, decade, he chose to be a college professor. You know, what's he going to go do next? Shoe cobbler? You know?
Well, I've gotten the feeling he's always kind of been a teacher of some sort. Even, like, say, when he's, you know, doing the Jesus thing inadvertently, he was still, you know, trying to teach people something. So I think that's more or less been his life's vocation, is, I think, to, you know, and pick up whatever you need to along the way to survive. But I think he's always tried to, you know, teach people things.
Right. But it's, you know, yeah, I see what you're saying about at some point your reputation is going to precede you, especially how much more difficult would it be to carry that off as time went forward? One of the questions that we have to ask in this is, why did he choose to reveal himself at the time he did to the people he did?
I think, because I was thinking about this going forward, kind of like what you said, is like, I don't think you could do that in today. Like, up until the mid-20th century, I think, yeah, you could fairly easily assume false identities and, you know, just move to a new area and take over an identity, that kind of thing. Kind of like the Highlander idea, right?
Yep.
I think you could, but not in today's world. Like, you would have to start, like, I think maybe that was one of the reasons why he talked to these people, is like, I think he's going to have to start going to third world countries.
Yeah, I don't think you can, given the technology, you know, in 2015, in 2000 it would have been easier, in 1985 it would have been easier, in 1970 it would have been a lot easier to fade into the background. We have face recognition software at airports. I mean, you're going to be spotted. If you establish a level of expertise enough to be a college professor, and you go someplace else and you try to be a shoe cobbler, somebody's going to say, but hey, I had you for a class, because people travel. So, you know, 6 degrees of freedom is a thing. As I was watching it, I was thinking, okay, why did he choose this time and these people? And to me, I think one of the reasons was this time was that it basically is going to be harder to hide.
Well, yeah, between that and just the fact that, you know, if you go to apply for a job, you either have to manufacture a full history somehow for this person, because they're going to do background checks. They're going to want certain information. There are people that do it. You could manufacture a whole history for yourself, but it's going to get harder, because cross-referencing social security numbers with dates of birth and everything else, if anything, he would have to become a master of identification theft or creation or something in order to pull this off. Because, going forward, I just see this getting harder and harder.
Yeah,
because, like, just thinking now, like, because I'm getting ready to go to Nerdtacular, right? So I'll have to renew my passport. Well, how the hell do you get a passport? Like, okay, how do you get a driver's license? How do you get in the system? I'm sure you could do it, but that, like, even professional fakes are not going to stand up to anything more than a cursory look by any sort of law enforcement person. And once that happens, like, the gig's up. What are you going to say?
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I just thought of now, too, is DNA. With DNA
or
banks.
Yeah.
Or fingerprints, yeah. Any of that, identification, bodily identification stuff, it's going to make it virtually impossible. Maybe they didn't really spell it out in this movie, and I'll just kind of throw it out there. Maybe you're starting to realize that it's getting harder and harder to do this. What would you do then at that point? Would you just come clean? Would you be able to survive, given especially the world as it is today with celebrity status and all this other kind of stuff? Would an individual like that be able to withstand the onslaught of people making him into a deity, a fake, you would be, I hate to say it this way, but you might be crucified figuratively.
Right. I mean, let's put that out there. Let's say that he revealed himself to these these people, they believed him, and they took it, you know, to the news and whatever. I mean, how does that play out? I mean, the one that he was worried about was medical. You know, basically they dissect him and try and figure out what the heck's going on. The one you just mentioned was the whole celebrity thing, where, you know, basically becomes a celebrity. I don't know what type of a celebrity, politician. You know, what would you do with that type of? I mean, religious figure. You said, well, I mean.
He already went down that road once, like I said, with the whole, you know, inadvertently, you know, for the purpose of this story, I don't want people writing and, you know, calling me a heretic or something, but for the purpose of this movie, for, you know, him basically, you know, being Jesus, he's already had a taste of that, because, you know, he spawned something that's, you know, gone all over the whole world. So I'm sure that he would be quite leery of that, but, and, you know, I'm sure that, but that would be in the back of his mind, that try to avoid that scenario again. But I would have to think that, you know, even though, you know, he's claiming he's not any smarter than us, he has enough life experience to realize that this could happen again. And in the world that we live in, it would be real hard for him to avoid that. So there must be, and they're making I think they've gotten the money together, Kickstarter money together, to make a series out of this. And maybe, and I don't know exactly what they're going to be exploring, but that would be an interesting possibility. What do you struggle to keep this hid, or do you just start, you know, embrace it and go forward? I mean, it would be kind of interesting to see how that could play out.
Yeah, it's really something to kind of think about. If somehow somebody found on a Okinawa where people live to be 120 years old all the time, you know, somebody who's actually 14,000 years old, and we could prove that somehow, and they really were this. Did we decide this guy's immortal? I mean, he cannot be killed, or like if you shot him in the head, he'd be dead.
I don't know if they said that.
Yeah, I don't know if they did either. I don't know.
Like, I don't know how it would be possible, just, you know, just statistics wise, to live 140 centuries and not, like, not be involved in some life jeopardizing
right.
accident.
Well, yep. He said he had bubonic plague. Yep. He had several illnesses. Now, I'm trying to remember if they said anything about, you know, accidents or whatever. He said he doesn't scar right. because they wanted to know about, you know, the crucifixion scars, because, you know, actually, you know, he actually went through it and he slowed his body down and, you know, kind of faked the whole thing. But what he said there was that they used ropes. It wasn't the nails. It's, you know, conveniently predict.
But even that's not like a massive head trauma.
No, no.
Or, you know, a piercing of your aorta or something like that. You know, it's... I guess they didn't answer that question. The question was raised. Somebody pointed a gun at his head and said, what happens if I pull the trigger? You know, so the question was distinctly raised, but I don't believe it was answered. So, you know, because if as somebody who had lived 14,000 years and was starting to enter a time where you could not keep that hidden any longer, I mean, the idea that somebody would shoot you dead shortly is probably pretty high. You know, I mean, there's, well, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, there's a certain contingency of people that just don't want, you know, whatever beliefs that you may have questioned. And I'm pretty sure, you know, this whole, you know, Jesus thing would have set up a bunch of people that would be very angry, which would kind of put, you know, a counterpoint to being a Christian.
We had him right in the movie. You had the well, for lack of a better term, fundamentalist Christian in there. And then you had the psychologist who also was getting a little freaked out about it and,
right.
you know, pulled a gun on him and whatever. And he wouldn't have been the only one. I think under different circumstances, like these guys were friends. If this had been a, you know, a stranger saying this shit in a bar sometime, you know, whatever, you know, you bet I could see it in America. you know, the idea that somebody would pull a gun on you and test this theory, that's completely conceivable for me.
Yeah,
well, like, I know I've heard I listened to Penn Jillette's podcast from Penn and Teller, and they do that trick, the bullet catch, and they never call their shows magic. They call it tricks, right? And they said he said that's their biggest fear for doing the bullet trick. Is that somebody will say, oh, I saw you catch a bullet. Here, catch this. because he said, like, this is a trick, you know? This is not, you
Bruce
know, and
Lee he had the same fear.
Yeah, and he had, Penn said that in the history of the bullet trick, what was it, about 10 people have died doing it. Three or four have died on stage, but the others have all been shot by audience members.
Mm-hmm.
Be like, okay, they stand up in the middle of it. Here, catch this, bang.
Yep. Yeah, and like I say, so to some extent, I could see where the reason that this guy would tell this story to these people, of all the people he's ever known, and at all the times he'd ever been through, is because, you know, it could be getting a little dicey from here on out. And I don't know if he was asking for their help so much as kind of realizing, you know, that he may not be able to pull this off forever.
Or you just, you know, you think about it, he has to keep that secret, and that tends to wear on a person after a while. Maybe he's just getting to the point where, you know, after, you know, 14,000 years, he's starting to get a little wary of, you know, having to keep that secret, and he just felt like, you know, confession is good for the soul or something like that. Maybe he just needed the psychological release to get it out there.
He did say he had essentially revealed it one other time. And that kind of they basically he thought he recognized someone else who had the same lifespan, basically, and they spent a couple of days talking or whatever, and then they parted ways, and he saw him again years later and thought it was him, but maybe it wasn't. So, you know,
I thought that was a weird kind of twist of the story, and then they just left it. I thought that was going to go somewhere, and
yeah. That needed to go somewhere, to be honest.
Yeah. In order for it to be, that's like the Chekhov's gun. Like, if you show a gun, well, somebody's got to get shot eventually, right?
Right. Yeah.
You know, they showed you this and then did nothing with it.
Right. So yeah, that was one. It's like, that is going to. You know, you mentioned that making more TV stuff or whatever Kickstarter off of this. That would be easily one that they could pick up and run with, you know, they find this other immortal, for lack of a better term. What do we call this guy?
Well, he's not necessarily, well, I mean, I wouldn't call him immortal because it's not since the beginning of time.
They kept calling him, what, Cro-Magnon?
Yeah, or there's another name, Magdalenian or something like that. But yeah, I don't know if I'd call him immortal because, you know, immortal would be as if you could take a bullet to the head and survive that. You know, he has survived some tough things, but other people have survived the plague and whatever other smallpox and whatever other illnesses that he had. Other people have survived that. Now, he survived several where that might have killed off, you know, somebody weaker, but I don't think immortal would be lucky, incredibly lucky, I would say, because you've lived this long and you haven't, you know, he dodged a Vesuvius and, you know, some of those natural calamities like that.
Right. I'm just skimming through some of the information off of IMDb about this. There were no deleted scenes for this movie and only 3 deleted lines. It's because it was a play. You just read it straight through. Yeah. Filming locations. 1, they give the address. It's in California.
Give the address.
I know it.
That's funny.
It's seriously Peterson Road in California. Jeez. Anyway, so like I say.
Well, and you know, Jerome Bixby, the guy who wrote this, you know, basically he took his Star Trek episode and recycled it, but he wrote it on his deathbed. So I don't know that he ever saw the movie made. But this was one of the last works that he did.
Yeah, again, the concept behind it, the ideas behind it are fun to wrestle with. I love it. They got a lot to chew on there. As a movie, yeah, whatever.
Well, it passed my clock test. I mean, I found it, you know, interesting. I guess I was kind of the characters, you know, involved More so than anything, I was kind of interested to see how they would react, because, you know, like I said, you had the one guy that was basically being scientific, just, you know, get all this information out there. You had the devout Christian who, when, you know, at first she was accepting, but then when they got to the whole, you know, Jesus thing, then she, you know, starts to lose her cool. You had the psychologist, which may have needed a psychologist himself, or, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think the character study itself is what kept me fascinated, along with, you know, the story itself.
Right, yeah. And it was an interesting cast of characters. Like I say, they specifically chose those professions and those personalities to have the discussion. I mean, it was a great sample.
You had said
pack.
Earlier normally it would be just people from the same department, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that's why, like, they specifically didn't do that, because they wanted people from these different disciplines so yep. they could each kind of give their own feedback. And
yep. So yeah, we only wish you could get those types of cross-discipline discussions going. That's where good stuff happens. But
well,
let's
I guess
see.
We kind of flogged this to death.
Yeah,
but
the technology. What technology do we want? I don't know. The Johnny Walker Green?
Yeah, we could all be immortal.
There you go.
Yeah, that might be boring. There was actually one bit of tech kind of behind the movies. The producers credited BitTorrent with getting it out there so more people could see it. So they actually kind of thanked the BitTorrent people.
Boy, that never happens.
No, but it got recognition, and then they kind of encouraged people to go out and buy the DVD or, you know, rent it or something so that they could make money on it. But they did, you know, sort of praise BitTorrent, so there's a little bit of tech behind the movie.
Hmm.
Other than that, I don't think there's any tech that we would want.
I'll take the cabin in the woods. I'll take the fireplace. Yeah. How's that?
I take living in California right now.
Oh,
so humid here. All right. So I guess that wraps it up for this episode of Sci-Fi Tech Talk. You can check us out at scifitechtalk.com, where there's some cool space junk. Somebody just moved the notes down and is moving the page.
Oops.
So you can follow us on Twitter at Sci-Fi Tech Talk. If you have ideas or comments, please send them to scifitechtalk@gmail.com, and reviews on iTunes are always welcome. So, Julie, where can people find you?
In the Google document, messing it up for Jeff. I can be found on Twitter at Julie Kuehl, JulieKuehl. And links to the other blogs, podcasts, and whatever else I might have going on can be found at about.me/JulieKuehl.
And, Mike, where can people find you?
I can be found on Twitter at DSCChipman, and I have an about.me page at about.me/MikeMcPeak. That's MCPEEK.
All right, and people can follow me on Twitter at BroncoSire. That's SYER. That's it for this show, and we'll see you in the future.
Quick reminder, Heather. Quick reminder, Heather. It's the Sci-Fi Tech Talk.